It's 9:06.
Good evening, I'm Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. Tonight, an outstanding military historian traces the course of weapons technology in American history and reaches a startling conclusion. West Point Professor Jenny Kiesling maintains that recent high-tech, low-casualty successes, the NATO bombing in the Balkans, Operation Desert Storm against Iraq, represent a dramatic departure from the American way of war. And that has uncertain consequences for the future. Professor Kiesling's remarks came at the second annual Pershing Military History Lecture at Boston University. We'll follow her talk with comments by Dr. Yoakum Matra, Director of Boston University's Division of Military Education, and Lieutenant Commander Rick Miller of the United States Navy. Here now are excerpts from Technology, the American Way of War, a lecture by Professor Jenny Kiesling.
This lecture will argue that however important technological supremacy is to contemporary American soldiers, our reliance on technological solutions is of recent vintage. The main theme of the American Revolution is anything but technological. The colonists trusted not in superior weapons, but in the justice of their cause. Recruiting occurred largely from the pulpit, and called upon Americans to demonstrate their piety and love of community. To emphasize superior weapons, even had they had them, would have undermined exhortations to faith and sacrifice. At its roots, I suggest, the American way of war is far more ideological than technological. For this lecture, I'm going to survey American military history, testing conventional assumptions about American technology-mindedness against the actual behavior of the United States Army and occasionally the other services as well. My first topic is small arms development. The 18th century was the age of the flintlock musket. The first half of the 19th century saw huge innovations. In 1816, the percussion cap made the flintlock obsolete because percussion caps speeded the loading process and worked in wet weather. In the 1830s, the cylindroconoidal projectile, you probably call it the mini ball, made rifles practical on the battlefield. Previously, rifles had fired the same round ball as the musket. To make the ball engage the grooves of the rifle, you had to wrap it in a leather patch, push it down the barrel, and hammer it with the ramrod. Using the cylindroconoidal round, that is the mini ball, you just dropped it in the barrel, and it seated itself in the rifling when the powder charge expanded the barrel of the projectile. Now the rifle could be loaded as fast as the musket, but it had 10 times the range and enormously more accuracy. In 1838, even as the mini ball made the muzzle-loading rifle efficient, Swiss Johann Dreiser patented a bolt-action breech-loading rifle that condemned those same muzzle loaders to the scrap heap of history. Bolt-action provided a much higher rate of fire and allowed for reloading while lying down or under cover. In the world of military small arms, this was the greatest age of transformation in 150 years. But you wouldn't know it from the products of the United States Army's arsenals. Thus, the standard weapon of the Mexican War was based on an 80-year-old design. As one student of the subject put it, our government was manufacturing museum pieces. In 1841, 25 years after the percussion cap was invented, the United States Army began producing its first percussion cap rifle. The U.S. model 1841, however, used the round ball and leather patch rather than Minnie's expanding cylindroconoidal round. These rifles were rebored to .58 caliber to take the mini ball only in the 1850s. The standard weapon of the war between the states, the Springfield model 1861, was a muzzle-loading, percussion-cap, rifled musket, a dinosaur in a world of breech-loading, bolt-action rifles and metallic cartridges. Okay, I promise not to mention the word caliber for at least 15 minutes. During this period in which the United States Army was consistently holding itself two decades behind Europeans, the country as a whole showed unequaled enthusiasm for technological innovation. Except apparently for military small arms, Americans liked machines and rewarded people who invented them. Of all the kinds of machines, Americans were particularly fond of machine tools, machines designed to build other machines. You may never have heard of David Bushnell's submarine, but you know that Eli Whitney invented mass production. Mass armaments production obviously suits armies, which like their weapons to be numerous and interchangeable. Mass production militated against innovation and in favor of simplicity. Energy that might have gone into weapons technology went instead into superior production methods. The resulting combination of high quality and, in wartime, huge quantity astonished Europeans, who coveted American machine tools. Here we find a clear continuity in our history. Whatever the American way of war may be, the American way of war production is the efficient manufacture of enormous quantities of identical and reliable weapons. In addition to observing the glacial development of the infantry musket, another way of assessing the technology-mindedness of the 18th century Army is to study accounts of the so-called Delafield Commission sent overseas in 1854 to investigate how Europeans were conducting their war in the Crimea. Three commissioners, the youngest of them, Captain George McClellan, were as technologically educated as any officers in the Army, but their interest was not in hardware. The commissioners noted Britain's wonderful achievement in connecting her Army's Crimean headquarters by telegraph with the High Command in London. They acknowledged the existence of ironclad warships. These technological marvels notwithstanding, the Commission denigrated Britain's military importance on the ground that grounds and Army morale was low. Crossing the Channel, they acquired an even lower opinion of America's traditional military mentors, the French. Equating French rudeness with incompetence, the commissioners decided that they had nothing to learn from the Army that would soon field the excellent Chassepot breech-loading rifle and an effective machine gun. The Russian army, though in the process of losing the Crimean War, gained the commissioners' complete approbation, won over by polite treatment and tours of spotlessly clean facilities. There's nothing in the reports about vodka. The commissioners ignored Russia's technological backwardness. McClellan's 140-page report praised the Russians for intelligence, courage, and skill. Ignoring rifles and their impact on cavalry, McClellan advocated an American Cossack cavalry based on the tradition of spurs and saber. The only weapon adopted as a result of the Delafield Commission was the French 12-pounder Napoleon gun howitzer, the standard artillery piece on both sides in the Civil War. A muzzle-loading smoothbore with shorter range and less accuracy than available rifled artillery, the Napoleon was the culmination of a 500-year-old tradition, already obsolescent in Europe. Gunners liked the Napoleon for its wide bore, which unleashed a devastating load of canister compared to that of the rival and smaller bored 3-inch ordnance rifle. A tin can full of scrap metal was low-tech but effective. The moral of the story of the Delafield Commission is that American soldiers valued morale, discipline, and courage over technological superiority. One might expect war to stimulate technological innovation, but the Civil War reinforces the picture of an army content with rifled muskets and smoothbore cannon. Excellent breech loaders like the Sharps and even repeating rifles like the Spencer and the Henry saw action. But the Army was in no hurry to re-equip hundreds of thousands of men with expensive new weapons. Military leaders were not looking to end the war with a deus ex machina. On the contrary, inventors often met a cool reception in Washington. Although Alfred Gatling patented his machine gun in 1862, he struggled even for an opportunity to demonstrate the device. Finally tested in 1864, the Gatling gun was deemed too pricey at $1,500 a copy. But perhaps it is just as well that Civil War generals were content to fight with what they had rather than seeking technological panaceas. Otherwise, President Lincoln might have had to deal with a refusal by the notoriously cautious General McClellan to advance on Richmond until the secret weapons were ready. None of this is to suggest that Americans did not like technology. Railroad and telegraph revolutionized communications. Improvements in production allowed the Navy to build fleets of so-called 90-day gunboats and the Army to equip hundreds of thousands of troops with all the paraphernalia of war. Confederates knew what they were talking about when they complained about being out-manufactured by the industrialized North, while the Confederacy created an industrial miracle of her own under far more difficult circumstances. The Civil War reinforces the idea that America's historic love of technology manifests itself in production, in arming troops with serviceable weapons rather than inventing superweapons. As during the Revolution, simple weapons suited the American psyche. Civil War soldiers shared the values of their forefathers. The rhetoric that brought men into rival armies called upon them to demonstrate their manhood, their courage, their love of country. To emphasize the lethality of weapons was to turn war into a conflict of machines rather than of young men reared to be patriots and Christians, not cold-blooded, technologically enhanced killers. After the carnage ended and the Army shrank to a fraction of its wartime size, interest in technological innovation remained slight. Although breech-loading repeating rifles had made their mark in the Civil War and were eagerly sought by the Indians, who were the Army's current adversary, the Army never sought a technological superiority in small arms. While European and Japanese armies progressed rapidly from bolt-action rifles in the 1850s to magazines and smokeless powder in the 1880s, the United States in 1873 adopted the single-shot black powder trapdoor Springfield and used it until forced by sheer embarrassment to test European weapons in 1890. At that point, the Army finally chose a magazine rifle, the Norwegian Krag Jorgensen. Still leery of rapid fire, Americans fitted the Krag with a magazine cutoff on the assumption that American marksmen would normally load and fire one round at a time, saving magazine fire for emergencies. Although regular soldiers had the Krag by 1897, there were none to arm the volunteers of 1898, so American troops in the Spanish-American War carried the trapdoor Springfield, a weapon which would not have seemed out of place in the Civil War. Our Spanish adversaries, on the other hand, had Germany's modern model 1894 Mauser, similar to the 1898 model, which saw service as late as World War II. Thoroughly outmatched, the United States bought Mauser patents and from the German weapon developed the Springfield model 1903 and its famous model 1906 30 caliber cartridge. Henceforth, the Army took infantry small arms seriously, although it is worth mentioning that the magazine cutoff switch survived on the Springfield. In the long run, the Springfield marks a turning point in America's attitude towards technology, or the Army's attitude towards technology. Though there would always be disputes about what constituted the best possible rifle, no one denied that our soldiers ought to have it. But that was the long run. In the short run, When the United States entered the Great War in 1917, it had only 285,000 Springfields. Since American factories were mass-producing infield rifles for the British Army, it was decided to arm our soldiers mostly with the British rifle modified to take the Springfield sights and cartridges. Worse, some American soldiers arriving in France were ordered to trade their Springfields in for authentic British Enfields, complete with inferior ammunition and V-notch sights. This was to simplify ammunition supply. In other words, although we had developed a superb infantry rifle, we had not suffered a wholehearted conversion to victory through technology. Far from it. Americans continued to believe that military excellence was more moral than material. To quote from the War Department's Home Reading Guide for Citizen Soldiers, victory depends more on nerve and fighting spirit than on weapons and armor. The War Department manual reported that the best means of dealing with the new hand grenade, a weapon not in use in the United States, was to pick them up and throw them back. Another source points out that American skill at baseball obviated the need for training in grenade warfare. The history of the machine gun provides further evidence of American disinterest in military technology. Although the three great machine gun inventors of the turn of the century were Americans, the United States was the last army to adopt a fully automatic weapon. Hiram Maxim built his water-cooled machine gun in 1884 to be ignored by the United States, enriched by the Germans, and knighted by the British. Having disdained Colonel Isaac Lewis's air-cooled machine gun in 1914, the Army refused to reconsider in 1917, even though at that time there were 40,000 Lewis guns in service in European armies. John Moseley Browning built his guns in Belgium because the United States would not buy them. His Browning automatic rifle was finally adopted in time to see service in September 1918, but remains in service today. Ignoring the Maxim, Lewis, and Browning guns, we purchased the French Chauchat, universally derided as one of the worst weapons ever built. Allegedly, the reason we bought 38,000 of these, twice the number necessary for the troops available, is that soldiers kept throwing them away. The 1st Marine Division, incidentally, arrived in France with Lewis guns, only to have them replaced with Chauchats at the Army's insistence. Knowing that the American Army fought the First World War with British-designed rifles and gas masks and French machine guns, artillery, and aircraft, I set out to find contrary evidence of American interest in technological innovation. One method was to examine the memoirs of the commander of the American Expeditionary Force to see whether General John J. Pershing, grandfather of the man honored by this lecture series, showed any interest in technology. I think it's suggestive that he follows a one-paragraph discussion of the need for more aircraft motors with six paragraphs on the acquisition of horses and two on getting more chaplains. When Pershing first reached the Western Front, he observed that the British and French armies had, quote, all but given up the use of the rifle. They had come to rely on machine guns, grenades, and mortars. His response was not to investigate these new technologies, but to remind American soldiers of the importance of rifle fire. He did note that Britain and France had felt compelled by defensive firepower to develop tanks, but showed no interest in building one, which, if you look at this American model tank, will not be too surprising. Disappointed with Pershing, I sought evidence of American technological innovation elsewhere. In the Army's Military History Institute, I found two very promising publications from 1920. Frank Parker Stockbridge's Yankee Ingenuity in the War and from the Alumni Association of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Technology's War Record. Stockbridge's thesis is that the Allies won the Great War because of America's ability to supply them with superior weapons. He identifies six essential American contributions to the war effort. The Liberty motor is a pretty decent airplane motor, but it appeared late in the war, and it was obsolete at birth because the United States had ignored overseas developments, wartime developments. The Leavens projector for gas warfare was British. You can decide for yourself whether the trench knife was a war winner. The Davis gun was the Navy's solution to handling the recoil problem when firing a large caliber weapon from an airplane. To prevent the airplane from moving backwards, the gun had two barrels, and I wish I had a photo of this, two barrels fired simultaneously in opposing directions. So that the force created by the shell going in one direction would be balanced by an equal weight of birdshot moving in the other, with who knows what effect on the wingman. The paper grenade was just what it sounds like. It was designed to kill by concussion without sending any nasty metal fragments likely to harm the thrower, should he not have been very good at baseball. These are hardly war winners. But what about the gun that beat the Hun? I bet you want to know what the gun that beat the Hun was, yes? The gun that beat the Hun was a pneumatic rivet gun, which allowed American shipyards to build ships faster than German submarines could sink them. That was indeed a vital contribution to Britain's survival and therefore to the war effort. The riveter symbolizes the many ways in which Yankee ingenuity facilitated mass production of the war material necessary to replace the quantities being expended so fruitlessly in Europe. Thus, World War I reinforces the 19th century picture of Americans using technology less in pursuit of better ways of fighting than to produce huge quantities of weapons tried and true. Although the period between the two world wars saw dramatic developments in military technology, the United States Army remained relatively low-tech for obvious reasons. Technology cost money because it required more sophisticated soldiers, more specialized soldiers. It tended to separate the Army from the populace and thereby challenged our Minuteman tradition. As Senator Robert R. Reynolds said in August 1940, America had nothing to fear from the German army because any North Carolina mountaineer could hit a squirrel in the right eye. The Second World War does demonstrate a change in our attitude towards technology. Previous wars had been largely come-as-you-are affairs, fought with pre-existing weapons. The development during World War I of poison gas, aircraft, and tanks foreshadowed a new era in which military leaders would look to scientists and engineers to invent solutions to current problems. Examples of World War II wartime research and development include radar, rockets, proximity fuses, landing craft, nerve gases, biological weapons, jet planes, nerve gases, and the atom bomb. Clearly, government efforts to harness technological and scientific knowledge were greater than ever before. I do not see, however, in this increased exploitation of technology, any fundamental change in the American way of war. Two things stand out about these innovations. Many were not American. More important, Americans did not develop new devices as war winners, but as tools to help American soldiers do their job, or in the case of atomic and chemical weapons, to prevent catastrophic defeat. Some of the most impressive American developments were non-lethal, like synthetic rubber, or like antibiotics and DDT designed to kill bugs. In killing humans, we were far less technologically oriented than our enemies, the Germans, who were looking for the war-winning weapon, the rocket, jet aircraft, or Tiger tank, guaranteed to reverse the strategic balance. We had nothing like the Royal Navy's Department of Miscellaneous Weapons Development, a collection of mad scientists pursuing preposterous proposals on the odd chance that some of them would pan out. While British and German scientists were dreaming of ray guns and trying to knock airplanes from the sky with beams of light or sound, America sought her miracles, characteristically, in production. The classic comparison is between American and German tanks. From 1939 to 1944, Germany fielded a series of four tanks, ranging from the 24-ton Mark IV to the 68-ton Tiger II. The United States Army had the 30-ton Sherman, a tank capable of handling Mark IVs and 37-millimeter anti-tank guns. In other words, capable of handling anything the Germans had in 1939. After 1939, the Germans were far better armed. The Sherman's nickname among tankers was the Ronson, after a cigarette lighter advertised to light first time, every time. Actually, one tank crewman reports his tank having caught fire 13 times in one day, which is either good or bad, depending on how you look at it. A wartime study by the Army concluded that the average tanker could endure having two or three Shermans destroyed under him before collapsing mentally. Some heroes actually survived the destruction of six or eight Shermans without cracking, but only if two or three of the incidents occurred on the same day. Instead of investigating the psychological effects of tank combustion on crewmen, a technologically oriented army would have designed a less flammable tank. The Soviets did. The United States chose instead to defer building the heavier M26 Pershing in order to mass produce a new 33-ton Sherman, note less than half the mass of the Tiger II. The resulting armor balance between U.S. and German units in 1944, described by one historian as nearly disastrous, was a logical outcome of the American tradition. Rather than seeking the best possible tank, we put our energy into building vast numbers, over 44,000 copies of a simple, reliable design, and one light enough for dockyard cranes, transoceanic transports, and the standard Army pontoon bridge. It was okay that it took seven Shermans to beat a Tiger, since Germany built only about 8,000 first-class tanks, many of which were engaged in the East against approximately 100,000 Soviet machines. What we do not see here is a policy of using superior hardware to conserve American lives. On the contrary, our men fought with inferior weapons and knew it. A 1944 book entitled American Tanks and Tank Destroyers by Elizabeth Conger, admittedly aimed at adolescents, describes tank destroyer training in revealing terms. She claims that the course was based on British commando training, emphasizing infiltration, jiu-jitsu, and, quote, other combat tricks. Armed with Tommy guns and .45 caliber automatics, tank destroyer crews were the only soldiers, quote, taught to shoot from the hip in the old Western style. Conger reports that each tank destroyer battalion had a stalker company divided into gangs of 8 to 10 men led by a super thug and an assistant thug. I had to make this up. It wasn't in the book. The gang's mission was, quote, to prowl around enemy camps using their double-edged knives to silence sentries. So you can imagine the tank destroyer crew getting out of their tank destroyers, sneaking into German camps and killing sentries with a Fairborn Sykes fighting knife. This is obviously nonsense, but it's fascinating as a 1944 snapshot of how Americans viewed their own way of war. It was heroic to fight German tanks with commando knives. It is the same vision standing out in contemporary recruiting posters. which do not advertise lethal technology but appeal to values: patriotism, protection of loved ones, manliness, and the justice of the cause. One question begged so far is, what about strategic bombing? What about the bombing of Germany and Japan? Were these not efforts to use technology to defeat the enemy while sparing American lives? This could be a very long subject, so you don't want me to go into it, but a short answer is that the strategic bombing campaigns did not reflect a general conversion to victory through technology. The apostles of air power were a tiny minority within the Army whose grandiose claims were largely contradicted by events. Leaving aside the atomic bomb, bombing did not force Germany and Japan to submit and proved enormously costly in lives as well as money. Aviation's true victory in World War II was the one aviators wanted most, securing independence from the Army. And since 1947, one could argue half seriously that military technologists have been segregated in the Air Force, which seized upon technology as a way of competing with the traditionally anti-technology Army for missions and funding. Another subject for which there is no time is the Korean War. It would be surprising for Korea to have created much technological innovation, since it was an unwanted war, a short war, and a distraction from the Army's central mission in Europe. The Vietnam War was like Korea, in the sense that the United States Army did not want to be there, nor to reshape its force structure to fight under Asian conditions. On the other hand, this was a longer conflict and one that American soldiers were for a long time determined to win. In pursuit of victory, we looked far more than in any previous war for magic bullets. The M16, napalm, Agent Orange, precision-guided munitions, flechettes, Claymore mines, all of the transport and communications assets connected with air mobile operations, sensors capable of smelling enemy bodies, these were all attempts to use hardware to magnify the power of the American soldier. In three ways that come immediately to mind, however, we remain far from today's notion of technological war. First, no more than in Korea did American soldiers feel happy and confident because of their technological advantages over the enemy. They were more aware of unsuitable boots, jamming rifles, and vulnerability to primitive weapons like mines and punji stakes. Second, Vietnam did not offer a good context for boasting about our technology. Compare the Gulf War, in which the Air Force proudly released trophy shots, one bomb, one bunker. In the first televised war, the equivalent would have been B-52s cratering or defoliating the very country for whose independence we were fighting. The poor fit between our technology and our political objectives made that technology almost embarrassing. Third, to return to a consistent theme in this story, Americans still thought of war as a test of human beings rather than hardware. I offer this point tentatively, aware that hostility to America's involvement in that conflict undermined national consensus about the nature of the American soldier. My subjective feeling, however, is that if one ignores the more politically charged portrayals and looks instead at the beliefs of ordinary Americans, our soldiers in Vietnam looked much the same, especially in their minimal reliance on technology, as their forebearers in Korea or World War II. But how to demonstrate the thesis that the period from 1940 to 1971 is one of continuity in American attitude towards war and technology? It occurred to me that the evidence lay not in the library of the Army War College, which is woefully short of comic books, but in my personal collection. I arrived home late on a Friday night and disappeared, to be discovered by my long-suffering husband immersed in Marvel Comics. I explained that I hoped to use Sergeant Fury and the Howling Commandos to demonstrate low-tech American heroism defeating German secret weapons in support of an argument about the Vietnam War, and waited for the derisive response. What I did not expect from an Oxford PhD in most obscure mathematics was the reply, like when the howlers destroyed the German heavy water plant or the jet aircraft? Exactly, I said. Nick Fury's squad of howling commandos fights against the Germans in World War II, but the comics were published during the Vietnam era and were written to appeal to contemporary Americans like me. The scripts pitted American values and biceps against Nazi viciousness and technology. A typical howler mission involves parachuting into Germany to destroy a German secret weapon, a light beam capable of shooting down bombers, a germ warfare plant, or the death ray of Dr. Zemo. Always guarded by a regiment of SS troops. Although any howler could fire a machine gun from the hip or throw a grenade through the eye of a needle, the squad always slugged its way through the objective, doing massive damage to the German forces and to the sergeant's shirts. In one special episode, Sergeant Fury gets his commission in Korea. In another, dated August 1967, North Vietnam develops an atomic bomb, and the howling commanders are called out of retirement to squash the threat with their Tommy guns and fists. I'm suggesting that our vision of the soldier in the Vietnam era is very like that of World War II, so much that we had to borrow the pictures from the World War II era. I believe that as recently as Vietnam, the United States harnessed technology as a tool, as a combat multiplier, if you like, for its real military assets, the quality and commitment of her soldiers. Things are undeniably different now. Exactly when and how technology became central to the American way of war is another question too big to handle here, though I recommend it for your consideration. Today, pure research institutions like DARPA invest billions in the most speculative kinds of research. Doctrinal publications invariably begin with technology. Recruiting commercials depict war as a high-technology video game, except for the Marines, whose commercials cleverly suggest that since their technology remains fixed in the 14th century, they must have some other virtues. Today we promise through technology to make our soldiers as invulnerable as possible, allowing them to inflict harm without themselves going in harm's way. Technology may make that kind of war possible. If possible, it remains new. In our nation's history, it is only recently that we could conceive of a war in which only their soldiers or their civilians got hurt. From the Revolution through at least World War II, our wars have been fought by soldiers whose personal vulnerability announced our national invincibility. Our nation prevailed because its citizens offered the ultimate sacrifice on her behalf. What we do now is different. However effective our new emphasis on technology, historically, it is the un-American way of war. So what? Does it matter that the American way of war has changed? Is it important to correct a historical misperception about how we used to fight? I think it matters very much. Concern for the truth is part of it, and dislike for ahistorical assumptions that what Americans do now must be what we've always done. So is respect for generations of American soldiers whose victories came because of who they were rather than from what they were armed with. But I am more concerned about today's dangerous tendency to exaggerate what technology can do for us, about what happens to soldiers who put too much faith in hardware and pay too little attention to human qualities. There are obvious reasons, practical reasons for concern. Trivially, we do not want our soldiers to be so reliant on technology as to be helpless when deprived of it. Nor can we afford to pretend that technology will remove the sheer physical intensity from war. And we ask things of technology that do not make sense. Everything I have seen about the high-tech future combat system proposed for the Army of 2020 suggests that it could be defeated by a modern version of Elizabeth Conger's thugs, in this case motivated individuals armed with rocket-propelled grenades. Exaggerated faith in technology distracts us from Karl von Clausewitz's all-important admonition that the real challenge of military leadership is mental, the ability to keep the mind focused so as to make good decisions in the worst conditions of uncertainty, misery, and terror. My biggest concern, however, is that as we become more capable of destroying our enemies without risk to our own soldiers, we will lose track of what war is about. If killing becomes too easy and too safe, will we forget that the true measure of the effective soldier is not his or her lethality, but success in ending conflict? A favorite science fiction writer defines a weapon as a tool for changing someone's mind. I wonder if such tools can achieve conversion rather than temporary concession if the enemy cannot see the human face behind them. After I wrote this lecture, I realized I was basically wrong. But I was committed to a title, which was Technology in the American Way of War. If I could do this again, maybe my next installment is going to be a paper about lethality. And in particular, about the difference between killing for your country and dying for it. Because I think, and this is off the top of my head, and I have not researched this thoroughly, but I think the biggest change, well, the change that's particularly interesting, is that people used to be recruited to die for their country. And it was only after you got into the armed forces and were handled a weapon, somebody said, and by the way, you know, as Patton says, you know, you're not here to die for your country, you're here to make the other poor dumb bastard die for his. But that was a secret. That was not something that we were happy about or advertised. Nowadays, we do not recruit people into the armed forces to die for their country. We recruit them to have an adventure and be all they can be, and I don't even want to go into armies of one. But it's... But I do think the real issue is when do we begin thinking that lethality is a good thing? When did it become a good thing to kill as many people as possible? I don't think lethality was a buzzword in the 19th century. I don't think people were trying to develop weapons to kill the most people possible. Some people were, but that wasn't the army's business. After all, soldiers want to live through wars. Normally, societies develop military systems that are designed to allow engagements that people will survive. It's only recently that we have begun to develop systems that allow a different kind of fighting. So I would like to redo this lecture. Thank you.
Professor Eugenia Jenny Kiesling giving the second annual Pershing Military History Lecture at Boston University. Joining me now are the director of Boston University's Division of Military Education, Professor Joachim Matra, who is a professor in international relations and head of the Center for Defense Journalism. Thanks for joining me.
Pleasure.
Along with Lieutenant Commander Rick Miller of the United States Navy, who is a fellow in the International Relations Program. Commander Miller?
Great to be here. Thank you, Ted.
I'm especially interested in what Professor Kiesling perceived as a change in the way Americans make war. Not just in the technology, but in our approach to war. Do you agree with her that that's changed by the high-tech world? Or do you think we're still pretty much the same? We want to fight in a good cause. We want it to be over as quickly as possible, but we will see it through to the end, and so on. Commander Miller?
Oh, I think those fundamental tenets of wanting to fight for a good cause and wanting to terminate the conflict quickly still exist. I think we have certainly shifted to a technology focus, and I would agree with the professor in her lecture that we did not necessarily have that high-tech, cutting-edge technology history, you know, World War II and earlier in our country. But certainly post-Vietnam in the 1970s, the creation of the air-land battle concept and the research and development effort in the 70s that went into that, which then followed on in the Reagan buildup in the early 80s, certainly shifted, I think, the way that we equip and provide for the forces to a more high-tech, cutting-edge technology advantage. And that really grew out of a decision to have an offset strategy against a large Soviet bloc military to make up for the lack of numbers with a higher technology and a greater capability.
Professor Maitre, do you think that it also shifted the way that the professional military saw itself, as Professor Kiesling seemed to imply?
Well, she is not talking about the war in the Gulf and the most recent experience, namely the war against Yugoslavia, Belgrade, which were entirely atypical for the kinds of wars she talked about. The war against Iraq was really a no-contest war. We fought against a nation which was clearly third-rate, had no air force that it could commit, and in the case of Yugoslavia, it turned into the opposite of what you just said, Commander Miller, namely, we killed roughly 500 to 1,000 civilians in this war. We faced no opposition. Their air force never came up. And worse than that, we went in for a humanitarian cause and did not achieve what we had declared to be our objective. We now see the consequences of a new kind of a war where technology alone was supposed to be decisive. More, our United States Army did not perform, and we have the suspicion that perhaps the Army couldn't have performed had it gone in with the helicopter incidents in Albania. Our Army was not ready for a land war, which is a bitter consequence of preparing for a war primarily fought from the air.
So you maintain that, in some senses, both of those actions were failures?
I should think so, yes.
What about her feeling that that much of the American ability to prevail grew out of a willingness, a patriotism on the part of, in earlier times, of young men who strongly loved their country and were willing to die for it? She sees that now shifting over to a kind of a professional willing to kill for it. How did you react to that statement, Commander?
Well, it certainly, I guess I would take issue with that. I mean, the people that I've served with are very patriotic and believe in what they do, that they do that out of a sense of patriotism and responsibility to their country, and very much not out there to kill. I mean, obviously, if we have to fight and kill, we will do that. And, you know, hopefully we have the technology and the weapons that will enable us to prevail in that battle. But I think our forces have displayed in recent events throughout the last decade in particular, you know, very measured caution in trying to prevent unnecessary death in the actions that they've undertaken.
Professor Maitre?
Well, the incidents we suffered during the war in the Gulf, primarily incidents of friendly fire victims, have never been explained in terms of America's willingness to die for a cause. If you were to compare the GI of 1944, Normandy, with a soldier today who's superbly equipped, as compared to his fellow from 1944, today's army grows with the... It's a professional army. It's a very crucial difference as compared to the draftees who stormed the beaches in Normandy. Today's soldier is very much trained to rely on technology. He is not the one who goes over the top and takes the enemy positions in a land war. We no longer have this kind of a soldier, unless we talk about the Marines, a different breed of soldier altogether. He perhaps still represents the American soldier who does a job and does it well, although his equipment may not be first class.
Let's just return for a moment to her basic premise that there is a danger when a nation turns from the patriotic, only go when it's absolutely necessary, pulled in as a last resort, and yet now it's time attitude to... We are the only superpower, and we will make the decisions on how and where these conflicts either are allowed to rage or we step in and stop them. Does that change the way America makes war, Professor Maitre? Is that changing now?
Well, there are those who hope that under President Bush it will change from the gung-ho attitude as was represented by Secretary Albright, who after all said to a professional soldier, namely the Army Chief of Staff, what do we have armed forces for if you're not willing to use them? Whereas the regular commander's or general's philosophy would be to make sure we have a declared objective. We know exactly when we can get out, to have an exit strategy, and we can be sure that today, under the new president, this kind of thinking will prevail. Make sure that we use the armed forces for particular reasons.
Is there anything either of you would like to add? Reflecting back on the lecture and looking ahead to a changed administration and an uncertain situation. Commander?
Well, to echo what Dr. Matra said, I think the administration, you know, what they've said so far on defense is somewhat along those lines. The initial increase in the defense spending they're putting into what is generically called quality of life programs, things like pay and benefits and housing for the soldiers and the sailors to try and stem the exodus of qualified personnel and attract new people into the service. And they've talked about, conducting the review, deciding where they want to go, but, you know, looking ahead towards research and development and you know, possibly skipping a generation of weapon systems and, you know, investing in technologies for the future rather than immediately jumping into fielding particular systems. And in fact, they've put on hold, I think, you know, some production decisions on several programs, just waiting for these things to develop over the next few months before they make any final decisions.
Yeah, the real vital reforms perhaps are no longer possible in America. For instance, I think it was in 1973 when the commandant of the Marine Corps decreed that no married people could join the Marines, and he was immediately by President Clinton told to take that judgment back because, after all, young Americans who had decided to get married early may indeed join the Marine Corps not for financial reasons. What I mean to say is, in the issue of personnel, reforms are bitterly necessary. Make the combat arms attractive again for those young Americans age 18 to 21 who really would like to see action, rather than for those young fathers of a family who, with already two kids or three kids, young married, have joined for the benefits. And we know we have quite a few of these young Americans who serve for reasons other than wishing to wear a uniform.
All right. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Boston University World of Ideas program on Technology, the American Way of War. That was the topic of Professor Jenny Kiesling's Pershing Military History Lecture presented earlier. Following Professor Kiesling's comments, we talked with Dr. Joachim Matra and Lieutenant Commander Rick Miller. Join us again next week. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15, including shipping and handling. You can access us on the web at wbur.org or wrni.org. Tonight's program was produced by Vince Fairchild and Bob Zalisk. Our web